Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. The 7th Congressional District in Massachusetts is a sort of Fenway Park of politics, a lyric little bandbox of a great old game Democrats have played since World War II, shaping both substance and style of their national party. The district, like the ballpark, is steeped in great names and nostalgia. John F. Kennedy entered politics here in 1946, the handsome war hero who became an earnest young congressman.
In this country, in the last years, we have solved two of our basic problems. There is no need today for anyone to go hungry or inadequately clad, but we do have the basic problem of providing adequate housing. I will fight for a continuation of our low-income public housing, but also for the development of an adequate middle-income program, which is so essential to the well-being of this country.
Before JFK, the rascal mayor of Boston, James Michael Curley, held that seat in the U.S. House. After JFK, this was Tip O'Neill's rock-solid and adoring base for 35 years.
Mary Zamparelli. My God, Mary. How are you?
Gee, I'm delighted to see you.
Hello, darling. Come over here. The Regazios I love.
Tip climbed the seniority path to become Speaker of the House and Ronald Reagan's tough but cordial opposition in the 1980s. Ever and always, this has been the House District of Harvard, MIT, and the Massachusetts General Hospital. At the cutting edge, now more than ever, of the information age and a federally sponsored boom in healthcare, high-tech, biotech. Not the least question in this political season is why lots of this district says it's hurting, why there's a contest for Congress at all. Ayanna Pressley is a popular vote-getter citywide on the Boston City Council. She struck a bold note just by challenging the 10-year incumbent, Mike Capuano. He's a shirt-sleeve liberal and ex-mayor of the melting pot city of Somerville. If you want to see and feel this district, Councillor Pressley says in a campaign ad, ride the number one bus between Harvard Square and Dudley Street Station in the old heart of Black Boston.
You can learn everything you need to know about the 7th Congressional District by riding the number one bus from Cambridge to Roxbury. People from every walk of life are on that bus. Everyone connected in that moment, just trying to get where they're going.
And so we did. And this is some of what we heard.
First of all, do you vote in Boston?
Of course. We need change around here. And we need to start helping out the homeless. I've been homeless. I was homeless for 4 months. I know what it feels like.
What needs fixing in your neighborhood?
I live in Upper's Corner. A lot of the stores are closed down because they're getting ready to put condos and stuff up. They're going to try to rebuild it, bring back people that want to work in the Boston, mainly the white people, and try to push all the black people out in the suburbs.
Peace of your mind, what are you thinking about the race?
Oh, Ayanna Pressley, that's what I want, yeah. She's all for the woman and the African-American people, so that's how I want to win.
What does this district need?
More houses for homeless people and, like, more job opportunities, more after-school programs and stuff like that, but definitely more housing for homeless people.
Massachusetts Avenue at Harrison Avenue, Boston Medical Center.
What does this district need?
Washington Help. Street,
money. Economics. They're not that good paying jobs. There's not a lot of good paying jobs. They're most of them in either hospitality or medical or construction.
What are you in?
Construction. And I'm a personal trainer.
What does the Boston, Cambridge, Somerville part of the world need most? For its state of mind, for its economy?
Everybody having health care, everybody having a job, everybody having an opportunity for the American way. I think it's the lack of spirituality. Look at the president. Look at the attitude that he brings to the White House, to the country, to the people. He makes more division than he brings people together. The people who are rich want to stay rich. They want everybody else to be poor. That's why he changed the tax code and made it so that the rich continue to be rich. And the rich are getting quadruple rich, while we're just okay. Just making it.
Central Square, Cambridge, can sound like a poor people's forum, halfway between MIT and Harvard.
The federal government should exercise its right of eminent domain and by the end of this week confiscate 30% of the assets of the 1% and redistribute that money to the poor people.
I've supported Cap 1 in the past, but I think it's exciting to get some new energy in the race and have people debating the issues.
The problem in Central Square is a problem everywhere. I mean, this is a capitalist society. It's gross inequality, racism, poverty, sexism. They both are, I think, committed to trying to do something about that. Who can do it more effectively? I don't know. That's the issue.
She's marvelous. But is this the right time for her to be voted in? See, that's... I'm not sure about that.
The question is, if all things are completely equal, then I would argue it's better to have a woman of color than a white male. But are all things exactly equal? That's what I'm still trying to figure out.
In Harvard Square, too, the complaints come back to homelessness at the bottom, luxury towers at the top.
Well, I couldn't even afford to live here when I was living here. I'm still annoyed that they took away Obon Pan so Harvard could build up more of their crap.
I mean, if a problem strikes me in Harvard Square, it's the homeless population. This isn't even discussed in American politics. Like, there doesn't even seem to be an ambition to end homelessness anywhere. I don't even know that I heard Bernie Sanders say very much about homelessness specifically.
I grew up in Cambridge, a few blocks from here, and I feel like, you know, I watched as I was a teenager when rent control was voted out, and I've seen the city of Cambridge and the surrounding area just become increasingly expensive and unaffordable, and have seen myself just with middle class friends who grew up in the city, all of us feeling like, you know, we probably wouldn't be able to buy a property around here the way our parents did. And we, of course, are very privileged compared to many people who maybe whose parents couldn't own property in the first place.
Well, basically, people are in a state of shock that Trump is president and the direction the country is going in.
Big picture, this is a rich, fat, happy, high-tech, well-educated, medical capital sort of district. What's the deep-down complaint, do you think?
I think still in all things like economic inequality, it's obviously true. You know, even with this last tax giveaway, people are actually making less when you take into account inflation. All the money went to basically buy stock up. I mean, they didn't invest it in jobs or anything. The economy was improving. There was no need for this tax cut. Things like that resonate with people.
Dan, you're an alert citizen. I don't want to make you miss your bus.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Gone for 30 years now is the magic of Tip O'Neill, an Irish townie from North Cambridge who, as a kid growing up, had mowed the lawn in Harvard Yard. As House Speaker in the 1970s, he still seemed to know everybody from the old neighborhood by their first names.
Jim Delaney and Jim McGrath and Lefty Quinlan, Porky O'Neill and the three of the Harringtons here, and Arthur Porges and Jimmy Wills, certainly. And, you know, I can look in every one of you that I can see, the Brogans out there. I can remember Feet, your brother. With every one of them, I can remember a happy incident in my life.
I asked Tip's son, Thomas P. O'Neill III, what his old man would make of the new district.
It's the question everybody on the street asks. Beyond his turning over in the grave, what would he make of it? He would not know the city of Boston as it is today, by the way.
Amazing.
And he wouldn't know half of the city of Cambridge's landscape as it is today, by the way, 25 years after he's gone.
He might be asking, how did they get so rich, Tommy? But then he'd also be asking, why are they still so poor in this district?
You know, it's incredible. I went with him to the Bunker Hill housing. God, I think it was his second to third last year in office. And he could not believe the poverty. He could not believe the conditions under which people were living. And I dare say 25 years later, that has not changed.
That's the amazing question out there.
Yeah. With all the monies coming back into the district, he could not believe those conditions existed. Remember now, he was an economic liberal.
Right.
And he wanted kids educated, he wanted people healthy, and he wanted a shelter for everybody. He wanted a roof over everybody's head.
Tip O'Neill was a peacenik, too. He turned against his own President Johnson on Vietnam in 1967. He probably wouldn't like our forever war in the Middle East, and he'd be baffled to learn that long years in office now count against a candidate.
We're living in a day and age when seniority hurts you and doesn't help you.
That's another aspect they're not talking about. But for seniority, there would be no Clean Harbor in Boston, much less a third harbor tunnel. There would be no Joe Moakley new federal courthouse. A whole lot of our real estate wouldn't be here. But for Tip O'Neill...
Well, you're talking about the Boston Tip O'Neill would not understand or identify with today. They built it. They put the underpinnings and the infrastructure together so that you have the Boston you have today.
Ted Kennedy...
That's what seniority did. Kennedy, Moakley, O'Neill, Conti, Boland, every one of them.
Right, and Conti was a Republican and a pal.
Yeah, and a pal.
What would he say? Remember seniority. That's the way the House works. That's the way Congress works.
He would fight a tooth and nail because seniority today is held in place with drain the swamp, which is, you know, really quite unbelievable to me. But it, I will tell you, in the 102 races that have taken place in the country since Trump's election, since he's been in office, seniority has not worked in the message points. That's all I can tell you.
Riding the number one bus, Tom O'Neill, from Harvard Square to Dudley Street, you could imagine a tale of two cities here. Tip never represented old Black Boston, but how would he be reaching out in government and as well as in politics?
He'd be working the streets just as you saw him in the 70s and early 80s at Barry's Corner. He'd be doing the same thing in Roxbury, Hyde Park, Jamaica Plain. He'd be reaching out to a community he didn't know. He'd be inviting them in, which is what he did.
That was the voice of Thomas P. O'Neill III. And before that, the voice of the people. The issue thread, as I hear it, is housing, housing, housing. Coming up, in a bastion of liberalism, the embarrassment of inequality. This is Open Source. In the fight around Boston for a venerated seat in Congress, this is what the candidates sound like. Challenger Ayanna Pressley and the incumbent Mike Capuano.
I'm running because I believe that these times require bold activist leadership and a leader that will restore people's hope, redeem their relationship with government, and extend a hand of partnership, and be an organizer, a convener, and a mobilizer.
You know, my family and I have lived in this district all of our lives. I still live in the same two-family house just a few blocks from where I grew up. That's why I know, with Donald Trump in the White House, we are in the fight of our lives.
If just the sound and feeling in political voices interest you, listen to our guest, Jimmy Tingle. He's a candidate for lieutenant governor this year, as it happens, a sometime comedian and TV commentator who stole the show, I thought, at the Democratic State Convention this summer.
Hello, delegates. It's great to be here today in Worcester. My name is Jimmy Tingle. That is my real name, and many of you know me as an entertainer. But I want to assure you here today that this campaign is 100% serious.
Jimmy Tingle, I wanted you here because you're a Cambridge guy who might have been Tip O'Neill's son, his love child. And I heard something in that convention speech.
Don't tell Tommy that.
I heard something in your convention speech that I think people pine for. Shall I say, liberalism of the heart, liberalism in traction, with traction, not in traction. Tell us again briefly that story you told at the convention about the Cambridge City Hospital.
Sure. And my whole premise is that government matters, and the government can change people's lives, and at times government can actually save people's lives. During the 1980s, when I was working as a comedian, I lost three friends to alcohol and drug-related deaths, And I personally was going downhill in a big way because of those substances, and I started calling places for help. Detoxes, rehabs, treatment centers, hospitals, and oftentimes get the runaround. There's no beds, there's long lines, call back next week, you don't have insurance. I called the Cambridge City Hospital, and I said to the man who answered the phone, I really need help. And without missing a beat, this man said, you called the right place. His answer was so profound, 30 years later, I remember it like it was yesterday. He said, you called the right place. I went into that hospital. I stayed 7 days. I got out. I moved to New York City. I focused on stand-up comedy and recovery. That's all I did for a year. A year later, to the week, I went on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. The other guest that night was Bob Hope. I take two things from that experience. Number one, I believe in God. And number two, I believe in the power of government to change people's lives. Everything I have in my life, everything, my wife, my son, my career, my education, my relationship with people like yourselves, the ability to run for office, the ability to come on national public radio is directly attributable to that man's response when I reached out for help. And I'm running for lieutenant governor in large measure to hopefully ensure that when anybody in the state of Massachusetts reaches out for help, the answer on the other end always will be, you called the right place.
Jimmy, it touched me. It touched a lot of people. But I think of this race in some funny way as trying out fresh voices for a demoralized national party staring into the abyss of Donald Trump. Who's going to talk back? And it's going to be a voice something like yours. Something's missing in what I'm hearing, even between two superb candidates here. What is it?
I think somebody in the first segment mentioned spirituality. And I think the soul. We have an intellectual approach. We have intellectual arguments. But the soul, how we treat other people. Where is God? God is in people. How we treat other people is what's important. And I think that's what's resonating with, well, that's what I think is maybe missing sometimes in the rhetoric. And the people who have picked up on the soul and the spirituality are the conservatives, the right wing, even though their policies don't necessarily reflect the spiritual principles of Martin Luther King, for example, but they talk about it all the time. And I think the Democrats got to get back on board and talk about what we stand for and where our moral compass is and how that differentiating ourselves from their version of religion and bring in our version of spirituality, which is about helping people.
Aaron O'Brien, it's your turn. If this race hadn't happened, I think you could have made it up. You've taught almost every angle of it in your political courses at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Yeah. Politics of work, of poverty, of diversity, of identity, of cities. I wish you'd speak directly to the riddle of identity politics, which has always struck me as lazy and lame. And yet, when Ayanna Pressley says it's moronic to describe this race as exactly the same policy candidates,
sure,
except that the difference in age, in gender, and in race. Obviously, it's terrifically important. How do we square that?
Well, I'm going to change your mind on identity politics this evening.
It's
this
the
very
politics
evening.
Of the candidate that looks like me going to be good for me. It's not a good idea.
But the research doesn't bear that out. We differentiate between demographic representation. So like Congress looks like America. Obviously, Congress doesn't look at all like America in terms of class, race, gender, and many other things, right? But that demographic representation has substantive effects. When people are in Congress or other legislative bodies that look more like the population, we know that those members bring different questions to the table. We call it agenda setting. They bring different questions, different policy interests, and they forward different policy interests. They concentrate in different areas. So demographic representation breeds or produces substantive representation. I think Ayanna Pressley has been very careful to say that this district, the 7th, needs an advocate, but not an advocate more than an ally. But she has gone on to say being an African-American female isn't her entirety. And so identity politics, I don't think, defines this race, but I think it's a mistake not to take seriously that no one in the Massachusetts congressional delegation is of color.
While you're up, speak to the seniority point. I mean, I love the idea of a new broom. God knows we need it. This city was built on the seniority clout in Congress for the last 40 years. Square that.
Well, I mean, seniority doesn't breed diversity. The seniority system in Congress has been lessening. You see it in the Democratic Party with people like Seth Moulton, out in Salem and Marblehead saying the Democratic Party's representation, the leadership is too old, they've been there for too long. It'd be one thing if Congress still really operated on the seniority system the same way it did under Tip O'Neill, but Congress has changed. So Massachusetts might potentially need to change as well.
And think of another necessarily creative industry that runs on a seniority system. It's absurd. So I'm arguing both sides of everything tonight.
That's right.
Our guest, Ben Bradlow, researches urban politics far and wide in Brazil, in South Africa, and in the 7th CD city of Somerville, Massachusetts, where he lives. We are fascinated, Ben, by your work at Brown University, at the Watson Institute, and your activism focused on housing, the politics of housing, the money in housing, and the demographics. As I said, I think it's the issue in people terms in this race. Would you start with the changing balance here between homeowners and renters? And this district is a real outlier on that renter-homeowner chart.
Yeah, the district is an outlier, but it's potentially on the leading edge. So in the district, about two-thirds of the households are occupied by renters. And in the country, 37% of households are occupied by renters, which is the highest number since 1965. So if you go back to that JFK clip where he's talking about housing, that's about the era that we're talking about in terms of the balance between renters and homeowners. So if you look at the platforms of these two candidates, there's a difference that's not talked about very much in the campaign, but actually reflects this. So the Capuano platform on housing talks almost exclusively about homeowners, in particular,
He talks about the house he grew up in. I mean, there you are.
Yeah, it's perfect image. And he's talking about things like assistance for mortgages and things like that. The Presley platform, I would say, is much more elaborated generally than the Capuano platform on housing. And it speaks much more to the challenges that people in the district and people in the country are facing on the issue of rent. There's some complications and critiques that one might lob at the precise proposals that she has on that front, but it's clear that there's an emphasis, there's a big difference of emphasis between the two candidates, and the emphasis on renters is much more in tune with where the district has been heading and also where the country has been heading.
You've noted that there's an interesting difference in the clout, the entitlement of homeowners and renters in cities, maybe everywhere. But it's the homeowners who have the longer stake or think they have, and there's a pecking order there.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that homeowners participate much more in local elections than renters. There are different interpretations of why that might be. Some say that, well, homeowners have more of a stake and therefore they participate more. The other possibility, which I think is borne out by a lot of ethnographic material, is that homeowners, in fact, close a lot of spaces off to renters, either explicitly or implicitly in the way that they shape political spaces.
There's also an interesting note in the news today that a homeowners or real estate alliance, in effect, has put significant money into the Capuano campaign. Is that suspicious?
Well, it definitely raises some concerns. The story in the Globe showed that the National Association of Realtors has given $300,000 to Capuano's campaign in this election cycle. So that's quite a substantial bit of money. Developer money has driven a lot of the Democratic Party, the party that's supposed to be for expanding the welfare state. That developer money has really closed off the ability to have a real conversation about housing as part of Democratic Party policy.
Erin, are you a homeowner or a renter?
I am a homeowner, very recent one, and that my house was flooded.
You're entitled,
yes.
Sister.
Well, speaking of government helping, the net flood insurance program really helped me this winter, so I am all in.
And you, Jimmy?
Yes.
homeowner.
And do you? Yes.
And my father bought the home, our home, with the GI Bill in 1954. And up until last week, my mom still lived there. So in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that we've been a renter and always had renters in our home and a lot of students, Harvard and MIT. But we grew up there and we were, you know, we've been there for whatever, 60 years, 70 years, not 70.
Welcome
60.
To the hood. We could spend all night on housing, various aspects of it, including the way housing skyscraper, relatively speaking, Somerville's first in Union Square, is tearing up the morale, the identity, the security of that whole neighborhood. What is to be done? I mean, Mike Capuano, in a sense, has presided or started the transition in Somerville, but all over Boston, people are talking about the displacement at Upham's Corner. New housing means white folk coming back into Dorchester. What's the federal role here?
Right. The market left to itself is supply and demand. So if you have a desirable place that people want to be, unencumbered, the market is going to dominate. And the highest bidder is going to get the apartments, and they're the highest bidder for the home or the condo. That's the way it is. And in order for that to be interrupted, there's got to be some sort of government or municipal intervention. And I know that they're doing that in Somerville. I know that they've been buying some homes and they have a lot of innovation in Somerville around housing now. But that's otherwise it's just the market economy and there is no check on it.
Ben?
Yeah, I want to go back to one of the women on the street from Cambridge that you played towards the beginning of the show. And she talked about the end of rent control in Cambridge. Hmm. And, you know, it's anecdotal, but she's telling a pretty causal story there. You end rent control and Cambridge became unaffordable, then Somerville became unaffordable. And, you know, that's kind of a third rail that in a high-profile race like this congressional race, I would be very surprised to see the candidates talk about that. And even Presley, who's talking more about renters, doesn't get anything close to rent control. In fact, she's talking about a lot of rent subsidies, which often also get priced into how landlords price their rents. But one thing I will say is in other races in Massachusetts this year, you're beginning to see some candidates talking about rent control. And that really, I think, may be a harbinger for what's to come in the next 5 to 10 years in the state.
And I think it's important to point out that who's a renter and who owns right now, there's a lot of historical legacy. There's some of the bad story of government. In Boston, it was very hard for individuals of color to get housing stock. And when we look at the differences in wealth amongst communities of color and white people, it traces back to hyper-segregation here in Boston. So in the first segment, we heard a lot of the good of Boston development. But while that development was going on, groups were systematically kept away from that housing stock, and that has multiplied over generations.
I'd like you all three to speak to what seems to me a fundamental, I don't know, anxiety in this race, which is about liberalism and delivery of results. It's one nice to be senior. It's nice to be considered effective in legislation. But what about the results? And the results in a rich, smart, interesting, historic district are kind of appalling. Simplest statement of it from the Federal Reserve Bank. Median net worth in Boston by race. White folk, $247,000 median net worth. Caribbean black, $12,000. Puerto Rican, $3,000. Other Hispanic, $2,700. African-American median net worth in the city of Boston, $8. How is that possible in a district that calls itself sort of fighting streetwise liberals? Ben.
Yeah, I mean, the question there is if you've got somebody who's represented the progressive edge of the Democratic Party in a period where you get those kinds of results, not just in this district, but that's, you know, representative of the kinds of inequalities we see nationwide.
Yes.
Then we have to ask, well, what does the progressive edge of the Democratic
Party
look like?
Exactly. And what does it deliver in the end? Jimmy Tingle.
Also, that speaks to assets. home ownership.
It's mainly home ownership.
I mean, if you own a condo or you own a house, your income, your asset is going to be $200,000. If you own a parking space in Boston, your asset is going to be $100,000. No, really, yeah. You know. But if you don't own, then that's where you see that incredible discrepancy in assets. But Chris, where you were talking about government, and I was speaking earlier about, I think what it's going to come down to is how is government going to deliver to people? Who is better? Regardless of party, who can deliver public transportation? Who can deliver high quality education? Who can deliver affordable health care? And that's what's going to really what people are voting for. And like I said, my father bought the house with the GI Bill. That was the United States government providing something to veterans coming back from the war.
But I think respectfully to the question, it's that if you ask voters that, especially on that one bus, which was, you know, superb, I loved hearing those voices, they're going to say neither party, by and large, that this economic inequality, that the wealth inequality that was just referenced, happened under Democrats in Massachusetts. It happened as Democrats dominate the federal delegation and the state.
You know, experience is great. A voice, as in Ayanna Pressley, an identity, a presence that changes the tone of the conversation is great. But then there's this matter of delivery, and it puzzles me. And I think the Democrats are all sort of on the defensive these days. What has it meant for this to be Tip O'Neill's district? Do you know what I'm saying? And not just brick and mortar building, but social measurable results. This is Open Source. We'll be back. Zaid Jalani has been listening to insurgent progressives all over the country this year, like Abdul El Sayed running for governor in Michigan, Kerry Harris running for Congress in Delaware. Zaid spends just as much time and effort to see who is supporting and opposing them with campaign dollars. He comes up with a somewhat different picture of the Pressley-Capuano race than we see in Boston-based coverage. Zaid's line is that our race says less about the post-AOC wave of upstart Democrats and more about a developing split within the donor class.
Both candidates have establishment backing of different sorts, and both candidates have a lot of financial resources at their disposal. As you'll remember, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was outspent 10-1 in New York. Abdul El Sayed was vastly outspent by the establishment candidate in Michigan, and also by a self-funding millionaire named Sri Thanadar. And race after race, we see the insurgents being dramatically outspent by the established incumbent. In this case, Ayanna Pressley is being outspent, but not by much. Additionally, Ayanna Pressley is being backed by a lot of people who are well-heeled. She's not building her campaign entirely off small donor donations the way a lot of these other insurgents are. She has the support from everyone from Barbara Lee, who is a Boston area mega donor. She is sort of an art maven, and also she's very interested in getting more women into politics. She's been supporting Pressley since she first ran for city council in Boston, and she's a very influential figure in Boston. She's being backed by Guy Cecil, who's a super PAC strategist. She has the backing of Minion Moore, who's a principal of a corporate lobbying firm called the Dewey Square Group. And she has the backing of the current attorney general in the state of Massachusetts. She's hired consultants who have worked for Deval Patrick in the past. And she has well ingratiated herself to much of, the establishment Massachusetts community. Now, on the other hand, I think Michael Capuano has done a lot of the same thing. He has the backing of a lot of his congressional colleagues, the Congressional Black Caucus, which often supports incumbents against challengers, John Lewis, Mayor Walsh, many, I think, of the same establishment figures that a lot of insurgents are going up against. But I think the difference with this race is that it kind of is one set of establishment folks up against another set of establishment folks, right? And in some sense, it's almost kind of like a more national establishment backing one candidate and a more local establishment backing the other.
Zaid Jalani, this is fascinating. I'm not quite clear why we were reading this in The Intercept, not the Boston Globe every day. Zaid, speak of foreign policy. Michael Capuano is a kind of come home America left Democrat. He was one of a handful of congresspeople who opposed the intervention in Libya in the Obama time. What's to make of that?
Yeah, so Capuano, you know, and we've interviewed some people who spoke to this. Capuano has been one of the more anti-war members of Congress. Massachusetts has a pretty robust anti-war community. I think they have a well-organized lobbying effort there towards peace and towards human rights. And Massachusetts Pizza Action actually is one of the groups we talked to. Basically, they said that Capuano has always been responsive to their interests. He's voted to try to end the wars in Syria, Afghanistan. He was very much against the war in Libya. And they actually came out and endorsed him, I think, basically the same week or the week before we published this article. You know, the difference here is actually they gave out a questionnaire to both candidates. And what they said was that Presley wasn't very attentive to foreign policy, that she didn't come to their meetings, she didn't accept briefings by their experts. And a number of the answers she gave to the questionnaire didn't really match the progressive mantle that she's been portraying to the public. For instance, you know, both candidates were asked if they would oppose legislation that would penalize supporters of the BDS movement. The BDS movement seeks to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel for its treatment of the Palestinians. Capuano said that, you know, he's not a supporter of BDS, but he does oppose all legislation that would penalize people for that because it would be against the First Amendment. Presley, on the other hand, did not answer that question. She left that blank.
Sum up the nuanced view in your Intercept piece. It's not Ocasio-Cortez in New York. It's not simply a progressive female against a congressional incumbent. What is it?
With this example, you know, I just don't think that a voter can look at this and see this as a left-wing challenger to an incumbent. I mean, in 2016, when Bernie Sanders was running against Hillary Clinton, Ayanna Pressley endorsed Clinton. She went on national TV and attacked some of Bernie Sanders' plans. She called them plans without a price tag. She defended some of Hillary Clinton's remarks around super predators. She generally said that you need someone reliable there. You don't need a challenger. You don't need an insurgent. She basically made the case against the type of campaign she claims to be running now, right? And this was 2 years ago. You know, and this is someone who's had a political career since 2009. So, you know, it's really, really hard to see this as a case of a grassroots left-wing insurgent fighting an incumbent the way that you would see AOC's race, the way you see that Carrie Harris fighting Tom Carper in Delaware or some other races around the country. And I think that's the sort of nuanced take that the average voter needs to take looking into this. You know, they should look at where Capuano has been throughout his political history and where Presley has been throughout her political history. They should look at the donors and endorsements. They should look at their current platforms. Put all that together, I think, rather than looking at this as a black and white case, I think that's the best way to analyze this race, and that's what we did.
That was Zaid Jilani of The Intercept. Ben Bradlow from the Watson Institute. Should we be listening harder for foreign policy overtones around this race?
You know, I'm struck by the characterization that this may be a representative of a split in the donor class between a local donor class and a national donor class. And that suggests to me that if this is also a race about the future of the Democratic Party, then there's a lot of work to be done on the left and in the Democratic Party as to what is a progressive foreign policy. I think that we've had a couple decades now, basically since 2002, when many Democrats basically capitulated, unlike Capuano, to voting for the Bush-Iraq War. You know, there's been very little creative thinking on the left about what a progressive foreign policy really means. So it's not surprising that when a woman who claims to represent the future of that party doesn't have much to say on these issues, even though she actually worked for John Kerry way back when.
When he was voting for the war or against
the war? I'm not sure about that one.
Aaron O'Brien, what do you say? Does that shake your devotion to the progressive candidate?
I'm not devoted to either of them.
Oh,
I have
sorry.
To be very but I do agree with The Intercept, that piece, that this is not a national race. This is I do not see this race as having national implications about the future of the Democratic Party writ large. I do think this is very much about the Massachusetts Democratic Party. The Massachusetts Democratic Party has been in control for a very, very long time. Parties only expand outward and bring others in when they have to. So the Massachusetts Democratic Party is very much an old guard. I think what we're seeing here are two moderate to slightly lefty, progressive. These are not progressive, but two pretty moderate to the left Democrats that are fighting for who's in charge of the Massachusetts Democratic Party. If Presley wins, then the gatekeeping power of the Massachusetts Democratic Party is in trouble. If Capuano wins, then it's like, you know what? We've been able to pick our candidates all along, and we're going to be able to keep picking them.
Meantime, we're going to get to the progressive and whatever the hell that means. But there's an expansion of language in this whole AOC era, and it's fascinating. Well beyond Bernie, people are talking about unfunding ICE, you know, the immigration police, talking universal basic income, as well as forgiveness of student loans and Medicare for all. What's to say about a new language of an expanded, liberated language of what people need?
I think so, Chris. And I think, to get back to your point about foreign policy and the wars, redefining national defense, health care, a form of national defense, education, a form of national
and security.
Defense, alcohol and drug treatment, a form of national defense, housing. I mean, taking care of our people. We have 900 military bases around the world at cost of billions of dollars. You know, what about our people? And nothing, I'm saying that we have the military hardware in these places. What about the national defense of what we were talking about earlier? Homelessness, drug treatment, education, housing, public transportation, veterans, you know, this type of thing. And that, to your point about, or to your question about expanding the language, redefining what national defense means.
Erin.
Yes.
Your turn. redefine it. And let's get toward this matter in all the language of who's left, who's liberal, who's progressive, who's a...
You know, I mean, I sort of take issue with the question a little bit in terms of I'm not sure that there's one Democratic Party. Me personally, I would, you know, abolish ICE. I'm in, you know, funding Medicare for all. I'm in. But that doesn't work in every district, and not every district wants that. And so I think the problem is, or one problem is, the two-party system, that I don't see that changing anytime soon. But I do think the Democratic Party, there has to be room in the Democratic Party for some moderate voices, liberal voices, and more progressive voices. Trying to come forth with one vision hasn't been particularly, it hasn't worked. But what has been rejected is the very neoliberal vision of a Hillary Clinton, of downward economic mobility, of giving the Dow, you know, stock reports when most people don't have stock. All this has gone. The Democrats have been, in many places, in charge as economic inequality and downward mobility has gone up. They need to put language around that, and there can be a range of solutions there.
There's no uniform Democratic formula, of course, but there was Franklin Roosevelt, and in our time, there was Tip O'Neill. I keep thinking of Tip doing his best in a very Irish kind of consensual pleasure, constructive relationship with Ronald Reagan, did his best to answer Reagan. I'm wondering, have we begun to hear the sound in this part of the world of a voice that can talk back to Donald Trump?
I'd put Jimmy up there when he said, you know, was talking about one thing the Democrats haven't done is said, we're doing these things for you and we are doing it publicly. So much of welfare provision has become hidden. You know, Jimmy listed a number of things that government is doing for people. Make it known in that sort of way. And so I think, you know, a Tip O'Neill or somebody in the Democratic Party has to be making that sort of case, because we know when people have positive interactions with government, efficacy goes up, participation goes up. They're more likely to support social programs for others. But we have to let people know what government's doing and also be very honest about where government has failed and has made their lives worse.
Ben, your turn.
Yeah, I mean, one place to start, you know, and I agree with much of what Jimmy and Erin have been saying, but one place to start is just to do policy that really speaks to the issues that are coming up in the district. You know, the way you even framed this show, talking to the people, and then look at what policies actually address those.
We were mostly listening.
Yeah, we were, and that was great. But you know, it really struck me looking at the policies of these two candidates that for all of the faults and shortcomings of some of the Presley proposals, which I think are in many ways stuck in a late 90s, 2000s progressive set of ideas about government. They were speaking to the type of people who live in the district. And the issue of the renter majority is one aspect of that. Mm-hmm. You know, we can talk about identity politics across many different levels. You know, and she talks a lot about how this is the only majority-minority district.
But that's representation.
That is substantive representation, because when you combine that with things like housing policy, and it's majority renters and majority minority, mm-hmm. then you see how these things intersect.
And she's seeing it, yeah.
It's an amazingly fun district to move around in. I mean, I've lived here sort of all my life. And people are incredible. But I got to note, there's something that seriously demoralized out there. An awful lot of people don't care about politics and say it, and they don't vote. There's also the sort of raging inequality question. There's also the deep confusion in all of us about where the Trump thing is going, what he's doing, and also what he means and how he gets away with it. So I don't know. I just want to note that I missed Tip O'Neill every step of the way around this district. A genuinely friendly guy who believes in the public sector, and he doesn't make a religion of it, but he's there. So glad you called. You called the right place. That spirit. How do we get it back? When did it go? I should say, Tommy O'Neill said his father. I said, when did it change and what went wrong? He said two interesting things. One, blame Newt Gingrich for just being a nasty character in the House, a thoroughly nastifying effect on American politics, and blame the Supreme Court for unleashing a flood of money. But how do we get it back?
Well, to your point, Chris, Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. And I think to get it back into what speaks to people in the district is what are the leadership and what are the policies doing to affect the people in the district. One of the most liberating things for me about running for office in 2018, I'm not walking around every day thinking about Donald Trump. I'm really not. I'm thinking about, if we get in there, how are we going to reform?
I'm going to go with you.
Yeah. How are we going to reform the funding of public education in this state so the quality of a child's education does not depend on the property values of the parent's home? How are we going to do that? How are we going to treat substance abuse like any other medical issue? If somebody breaks their leg, an ambulance comes, picks them up, brings them to the hospital, they give them crutches until they can walk again. We got to get to the same place with substance abuse so the people who need help and want help can get help and ultimately walk again. These are the things that people in the district care about. And I think both Mike Capuano and Ayanna Pressley are basically talking out of the same, you know, they're on the same page on 90% of their policy issues. So there's not that much difference between the two in terms of policy. I think they're both liberal, both progressive, both moving in the right direction. And we're lucky to have competition because it makes the candidates better.
That number one bus incidentally stops at the sort of opioid treatment capital in the city of Boston, a terribly upsetting sort of place. We still don't know how to talk about that, unless you do, Ben. I wanted to know, what do you do for distraction from Donald Trump?
I'm not running for office, but working in local politics, uh-huh. even outside of elected office, is a great way to not worry about Donald Trump.
And drinking heavily.
Take one last shot around the circle at progressive. Is she a progressive? Are you a progressive? Does it help to be a progressive?
To me, a progressive is someone who believes in social citizenship, that we are interconnected, and if you're doing worse, I'm doing worse. It's not about, everyone's not equal per se in terms of equality of outcome, but that in a civilized society, your government gives you a modicum. It gives you, you know you're not going to be on the streets. You know you're not going to be on the one bus and trying to get into a treatment center. So I think that sense of civility and interconnectedness has a lot to do with being a progressive.
Yeah. Jimmy Tingle.
And I would say how government is responding to the needs of people. Abraham Lincoln said the role of government is to do for people what they cannot do for themselves, but no more. So that's one definition of it. But I would say how we treat people, how we're providing opportunity for the people, for our own citizens who are the taxpayers.
Does it help to be funny now and then?
It does.
That's probably unfair. Thank you, Jimmy Tingle. Thank you, Aaron O'Brien and Ben Bradlow from the Watson Institute and Zaid Jilani and Tommy O'Neill. Admiration and thanks to Nancy Porter at WGBH Television for that amazing movie about Tip O'Neill from 1977. It was called Mr. Speaker, and you can see it online if you work at it. Thanks also to our unpaid political consultant, Pat Tomeno. Our show this week was produced by a slate of good candidates, Connor Gillies, Susan Coyne, George Hicks, and Mary McGrath. We say farewell and thank you to Zach Goldhammer, who is off to grad school, and we welcome back Rebecca Panofka. Welcome back to the work and the credits, Rebecca. Good luck. Every blessing to the 7th Congressional District. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.